Well, I was watching a game of checkers being played the other day between two people I know, and I noticed that the thing that tripped up one of these people all of the time in the game was focusing on the immediate prize that could be had, such as getting her piece kinged. You guys know checkers, right? And get it to the end, you get to king it. Rather than focusing on the bigger picture of winning the game. And because of that, it cost her a great deal. If she had exercised more patience and changed her focus to the big picture rather than immediate gratification, she would have done much better in the game. Now, I don't know if she would have won, but she certainly would have played a better game. We live our lives the same way, don't we? We too often let our focus be on immediate gratification rather than being patient and concentrating on winning the game. And as we'll see in our story today with Esther, she's a person who has put her focus on winning the game rather than on immediate gratification. We're going to see that she is a person of tremendous wisdom and great strategy. Now, a quick review of our story in the book of Esther up to this point is our story over the past couple of weeks has centered around a pickle that Mordecai has gotten himself and the Jewish people into when he refused to bow down and pay honor to a man named Haman. You may recall that Haman is a man who has somehow managed to get himself appointed by the king of Persia, Xerxes, as the number two man in the kingdom. And upon his appointment, the king then commanded all of the other royal officials to kneel down and pay Haman special honor. Well, everyone complied with that except for Mordecai. He refused to do it, knowing what this man Haman was really like, and because he was an Agagite, a long time and standing enemy of the Jewish people. Well, when Haman saw that Mordecai refused to kneel down to him and honor him, he was enraged. And so much so that he looked for a way to not only kill Mordecai, but all of the Jewish people. He wanted to exterminate all of the Jews throughout the entire Persian Empire. He went to King Xerxes and he told him that there was this certain people who were very dangerous in the kingdom because they had strange customs and they refused to obey the law of the king. To protect the king and the kingdom, he suggested that these people be completely eradicated. Well, King Xerxes doesn't really know what he's even talking about, but he gives Haman unlimited authority to do with these people as he thinks best. So Haman devises this diabolical plan for having all of the Jews killed. He sent an edict out in the name of the king throughout all of the Persian Empire, which said that on the 13th day of the 12th month, all of the Jews, young and old, women and children, were to be annihilated, and the people were to plunder their goods. Now, no one within the Persian government, including the king and Haman, knows yet that Esther, the queen, is a Jew, or that Mordecai is her family. So when the king gives Haman the power to do what he wants with these people, he unknowingly has signed a death warrant for his own queen and her people. Mordecai and the other Jews mourn greatly, fasting, weeping, wailing, laying in sackcloth and ashes, as we might expect. Try to imagine how horrifying it would be if the government of the United States passed a law that gave everyone else in this country orders to turn on you and your family and kill you on a certain day and take anything they wanted that was yours. How would you like that to be hanging over your head? Well, that's exactly the situation that the Jews are faced with in Persia. Mordecai told Esther through a messenger that what Haman had done, and he said that she needed to immediately go to the king and beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Well, that sounded like a simple enough idea on the surface, but there was a problem with what he was asking Esther to do. No one, not even the queen, was allowed to approach the king unless he had specifically summoned you by name. Anyone who attempted to approach the king uninvited was immediately executed. There was only one exception to this. And that was if the person, when they appear before the king, he extends his gold scepter to them, indicating that they are allowed to approach and then speak. So Esther told Mordecai that there was no way that she could go in before the king. The last time that he had even summoned her was 30 days ago. He would certainly have her killed on the spot if she just walked into the king's hall to talk to him now. Well, Mordecai said to her, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this." He said, if Esther remains silent about the fact that she too is a Jew and refuses to go before the king on behalf of her people, God will deliver his people through some other means, but she and her family are going to perish. Mordecai reminds her that it was no accident that she is the queen at this particular time in history. It was perhaps, he says, for this very moment that God has put you in this position. Will Esther realize that she has to attempt to speak to the king and plead for her people? This is clearly the will of God for her. So she asked Mordecai to have all of the Jewish people fast and pray for 3 days. And then at the end of that time, she will attempt to speak with the king. Esther would be fasting and praying too during these 3 days, seeking God's help and his wisdom. Esther didn't know what would happen when she approached the king, whether he would extend his scepter toward her or not, whether he would have her executed or give her a hearing. All she knows is that she has to try. This is the call and the responsibility that has been placed on her life. She chooses to do the will of God, no matter what the outcome is going to be for her. She says, "If I perish, I perish." We talked about how we're not called to be successful. We are called to be faithful. Faithfulness is something that we can do. Success is in the hand of God. So now, the story continues. Chapter 5 of Esther, beginning in verse 1, it says, "On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. So the moment has arrived for her to attempt to speak to the king." Try to imagine the tension in the air here for her. Her heart is pounding so hard in her chest, she's probably afraid he can hear it. Clear down on the other end of the hall. She swallows hard, she says a last prayer under her breath, and then steps out into the hallway, knowing that this might be her last day. I want us to notice that it says she puts on her royal robes and then went to speak with the king. She didn't go before the king in a state of mourning and sadness. She doesn't let on at all to the king that there's anything wrong, which, as we're going to see, is all part of the plan that she is carrying out. So in verse 2, it says, "When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked, 'What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given to you.'" Esther had no idea what was going to happen. And in fact, all of the signs pointed to disaster. But when she steps out into the inner court and the king sees her, she's greeted with a smile, a warm welcome. He immediately extends his scepter toward her. And not only does he extend that scepter to her, but he also invites her to ask for virtually anything that she wants. And he's going to do it for her. When he says, even up to half the kingdom, it shouldn't be understood literally. It's a figurative expression, but it basically means that he is willing to do anything within reason for her. The faithfulness of God is amazing, isn't it? How often in my life God's faithfulness has surprised me in the same way. I thought disaster was coming. I thought there was an axe swinging just above my neck. And I was greeted with a smile, a blessing of God instead. What did Esther do first before going before the king? Rather than immediately going in to see the king when Mordecai had spoken to her, she had everyone pray and fast. See, the battle was fought on a spiritual level before it was entered into on a physical level. It's important for us to see that. And that's really good advice for us too. I've been guilty too often of charging into the battle fray before I've taken the time to seek God through prayer. And the result has been me ending up on the sideline as a casualty. Someone once said, you can do more than pray, but only after you have prayed. A proverb that reminds me to slow down and take the necessary time to pray so that I'm operating with his guidance and wisdom is Proverbs 19:2. It says, it is not good to have zeal without knowledge, nor to be hasty and miss the way. There have been times in my life when I feel like Wile E. Coyote. I'm chasing hard after the proverbial roadrunner in my life. And I'm running so fast, so hard after the roadrunner that I don't even notice that what appears to be a road stretching out into the distance is really just a painting at the edge of the cliff. And I charge right through it. Prayer and patience go together. It takes patience to not rush ahead before seeking the Lord in prayer. It takes patience to wait and listen to God, waiting for his direction through prayer. And Esther's story, as it unfolds, we are going to see how prayer and patience work together in her life. In verse 4, she says, if it pleases the king, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him. That's interesting. What is Esther up to? What is she doing? See, we expect for her to immediately fall on her face before the king as soon as he extends the welcome to her and start pleading for herself and her people. Oh, you can't believe what happened. Oh, please save us. That's not what she does. Instead, when he asks her what her request is, she says, oh, I was just wondering if you'd be willing to come to a little dinner party I put together for you, and why don't you bring your best friend Haman along with you? I mean, it's not a big deal, but, you know. During the 3 days of fasting and praying, I believe that the Lord gave Esther some very clear direction about what she was supposed to do and how she was supposed to approach the king. Try to imagine what may have gone on during those 3 days of intense praying and fasting. Esther is pleading for the Jewish people before God, begging him to deliver them from this horrible fate. She's crying out to God, asking him somehow to change the heart of the king so that she, when she approaches the king will receive her and grant her request. And as she's praying, the thought enters her mind, prepare a banquet for the king and invite him and his friend Haman to come. What? That's ridiculous. How can I stand to even be in the same room with that vile man, much less serve him a meal? But as she continues praying, that same idea keeps coming back to her again and again. Prepare a banquet for the king and invite him and his friend Haman to come. And as she continues praying and thinking it through, a plan begins to emerge, and she has this strong sense that the Lord is leading her in this thing. So verse 5, bring Haman at once, the king said, so that we may do what Esther asks. So the king and Haman went to the banquet Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine, the king asked Esther, now what is your petition? It will be given to you. And what's your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted to you. Wide open door. He's going, come on now, Esther. What do you want? I'll give you anything. Just tell me what it is you want. See, his interest is really peaking now. He knows she wants something. What is it? In verse 7, Esther replies, my petition and my request is this. If the king regards me with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I'll prepare for them. Then I'll answer the king's question. So Esther asked the king and his friend Haman to come to another banquet, which she will prepare for them the next day, and then she'll answer the king's question. What a wise woman Esther is. And she has so much control over herself and thus over this situation. She understands the value and the power of anticipation, for example, and she uses it to her advantage. She actually has turned the entire situation around in a sense. Rather than this being a situation where she's begging the king for something, he's now asking her for something. He's now pleading with her to tell him what she wants. Interesting, the way she has worked this situation. It's a real contrast to place her alongside the first queen, Vashti, who was brash and foolish and disrespectful. She lost her position as queen because of it. Esther, on the other hand, is humble, she's modest, and she's very coy. We see in Esther what I would call feminine power being exemplified. She has the two most powerful men in one of the most powerful kingdoms in the world literally eating out of her hand right now. And how has she accomplished this? It isn't being done by trying to outmuscle these guys in any way. There is nothing masculine about what she is doing. She is using the unique qualities that God gave her as a woman to accomplish his work. See, if it had been me in her place, I would not have invited these guys to a dinner party and then to another dinner party and gone through all of this preparation to set up her big ask moment that's coming. I might have invited them to lunch at a restaurant, but I would have made no lunch for them. And I would have maybe made reservations at best. See, I prefer a very direct approach. I'm not good with small talk and chit-chat. If there's something to discuss, then I just want to get to it. Esther has a very different approach. Now, please don't take what I'm saying here too far. I'm not saying that all men are just like me, nor am I saying that all women are just like Esther. But there are some broad brush characteristics being displayed here in Esther's approach that are clearly feminine. And you know it. All of you know it. She's working these guys like only a woman can work them. Men and women are different in more than just physical ways. God made us different, and the sooner we learn to appreciate our unique differences rather than trying to eliminate them, the happier we will all be. Men do not need to act like women. Women do not need to act like men. Men should act like men. That's the way God made them. Women should act like women. That's the way God made them. Husbands get frustrated that their wives don't think and act and see the world the way they do. Well, they're not men. They don't need to become men to be good women. And wives get frustrated that their husbands don't think and act and see the world the way that they do. Men are not women. And they don't need to become woman-like in order to be good men. Okay? It's really important that we recognize that about each other. Finally, it doesn't matter if you are a man or a woman, tall or short, rich or poor, smart or simple, green or red, God can use you. There are unique qualities that he has given every single one of us which he can use to accomplish his work. So don't assume that because you are not something that someone else is, that it will prevent God from using you. Verse 9, the story continues. It says, Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I'm the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet that she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. Haman is so full of himself. He's bragging about his vast wealth and his many sons and all of the ways that the king has honored him and how he is Xerxes' main man. Not only that, but he is the only person in the entire kingdom who was invited to this special exclusive banquet that the queen held. And she's actually invited him back to another banquet tomorrow. I'm sure he thinks that she was so charmed with his witty conversation that she just had to have a little more of him. In truth, she was probably doing all she could to not puke. He's just storing stuff up for the humiliation that's going to come. Haman is going to come down in a big way. He just doesn't know it yet. Mordecai. Interesting man. He remains steadfast in his principles in opposition to Haman, even now. As we pointed out before, Mordecai is a man of very strong character. He continues to refuse to give any honor to Haman, even though at this point the Jews are in grave danger. I mean, in a situation like this, we might be tempted to try to kiss up to Haman, hoping that he would change his mind about us, about wiping us out. But Mordecai remains unbending in his principles, and rightly so. You want to close that door there? Sounds like they're having fun in the garden out there. This story is full of some funny ironies and dark humor. The comment in verses 9 and 10 about how angry Haman is with Mordecai, but he restrains himself and goes home. It's laughable. I mean, I picture him trying to keep his cool as he makes his way home, as he sees this man. He's like, and he just, you know, as soon as he gets home, he just blows up. Did you know what the literal meaning of Haman's wife's name Zeresh is? Not making this up. It's a Persian word which literally means one with disheveled hair. Not making it up. Some guys, you made that up. I did not make that up. And it creates a funny contrast, doesn't it? We have the cousin of Mordecai, Esther, a beautiful young Jewish maid who has won the affection of the king of Persia. In contrast, we have the wife of the arrogant, conniving, self-impressed villain Haman, Zeresh, the one with the big, messy hairdo. Haman, you forgot to dig out the trash last night. The image that comes to mind for me is Stella, the wife of Harcourt Fenton Mudd from the old Star Trek episode. Verse 14. It says, his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, have a gallows built 75 feet high and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go with the king to the dinner and be happy. This suggestion delighted Haman and he had the gallows built. Haman's happiness would be complete if it weren't for that one great irritation in his life called Mordecai. So his wife suggested he build a gallows 50 cubits high, 75 feet high, and have Mordecai hanged on it. And then he can go to his dinner with the king and be happy. And he thinks that's a fantastic idea. So he has the gallows built and goes to bed looking forward to speaking with the king in the morning about having Mordecai hanged on it. And we'll continue our story next week. In closing today, I want to bring us back to Esther's life attitude again. She's a big picture person. She looks beyond herself and her own personal needs and wants. She makes herself available to the Lord. She gives herself away in service to her people. She can't always see the details about how everything is going to play out, but she has her faith firmly in her God, and she walks with him wherever he is leading her. In one sense, she's a very good checkers player. because she prays and she patiently seeks God and waits for him. She doesn't grab for immediate gratification. She's in it to win the game. She understood the meaning of what Jesus would say several hundred years later in Mark 8:34 when he says, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul?" She understood the meaning of what Paul would write in 2 Corinthians 4:17. "For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal." Give yourself away in service to the Lord and his people, and you will receive real life back in return. Let's bow our heads. Lord, we thank you for the story in the book of Esther. God, we love reading about how you work in and through and for your people. You are an awesome God. Lord, I pray that you would encourage your people this morning, that you still work with your people like this now. You are at work. You're moving among us. You want to use every single one of us, Lord. Help us to give ourselves to you, Lord. Throw in with you 100%, all of us, all the way. And what you do, your great work around us and in us and through us. In Christ's name, amen.